Welcome to In the Room with me, Ronnie Barber. In this series, we'll be talking to politicians, YouTubers, sports stars, and scientists about the defining moments of their lives. From the classroom to the boardroom, the briefing room, the dressing room, and a whole lot more, we'll find out how the rooms of our lives shape the decisions we make. This week, in the room, I'm speaking to Chris Akabusi, the Olympic legend, gold medalist, and now motivational speaker. We'll hear about his upbringing in care.
I'd cried every day, wanting my mum, and I came down the stairs from the bedroom out into the big field, which was our garden. Stood in front of this weeping willow tree, which again is quite significant because it's a weeping willow tree with all of its boughs hanging down. And I'd had enough of crying.
How he treats every moment in life as an opportunity.
There is this joy and verve in life where you continue to make the most and play and recreate and dream big about what you want to become.
And we'll relive that iconic moment when he delivered gold for the UK in the World Championships.
Bam, off the turn. I go flying past this guy. And, you know, all the time, I've never even contemplated. It was never even in my mind that we were going to lose this. I knew we were going to win.
Right. The first room I put him in was in the barracks in 1975, where he started his professional life in the army.
So I joined the army straight from the children's home. I've been living in the children's home my mother and dad sort of left me in the UK when I was four with foster parents. I then went to the children's home when I was eight. And at 16 and a half, the night I decided to go and join the army, it was really out of desperation. I was really frightened of the reality that I was going to leave the children's home. I had nowhere else to go. I was an immature 16-year-old. I knew that if I went to Bedsit Land, I'd get myself into trouble. I knew I was easily led. And I understood even at 16 that the army had this sort of infrastructure and a ready-made family, and that whatever happened at the end of the month, if I had no money, they were still going to feed me.
Yeah.
So it was really out of that necessity. I guess in a way, I was going from one institution, the children's home, to another institution.
That's what I was going to say, the structure was important. You know, that you went from, you knew when meal times were, and you went to another time when you did that. Can we talk about your years in care? What was it, 8 years you were in care, Chris?
Yes, 8 years I was in the children's home, yeah.
What was that
and
like?
The children's home was a good experience in as much as, once again, there was this safety net that was there for me. I guess this is also a negative as well as a positive, in as much as I was immersed in diversity. So there was no one monoculture in the children's home. There was people from Ireland, the West Indies, Turkish Cypriots, Greek Cypriots, Irish people. My background is African. There was obviously just general sort of Caucasian English people there as well. So, you know, so there was no monoculture, which is a strength and a weakness, because there's no definitive way of being in the world. And yet you're open to all of these different ideas and spirituality and ways of being. And of course, there was also the introduction into being naughty. Because, you know, you got kids there whose mums and dads were drug addicts, were gangland leaders, were, pimps and prostitutes. And you got all sorts of kids that are there as well. So you're introduced to all sorts. But I was aware that I was dependent in the choice. I tell you, one big, we're not in this room, I know we're in the army, but while we're talking about being in the children's zone, there was one big moment there that really drastically changed my life. I was 12 and a half years of age. I'd cried every day, wanting my mum. And I came down the stairs from the bedroom out into the big field, which was our garden. Stood in front of this weeping willow tree, which again is quite significant because it's a weeping willow tree with all of its boughs hanging down. And I'd had enough of crying. I stood in front of this tree, which sounds a little bit woo-woo, and said, I want my mummy, I want my mummy. Where's my mummy? Where's my mummy? And if trees talk, and I'll leave that one out there, but if trees talk, I sort of heard a tree say to me, mummy isn't coming. Mummy isn't coming. And all of a sudden, as if scales fell from my eyes, when I heard that, I realised that I was going to have to be enough. I was going to have to be in charge of my life. And that was a real metamorphosis, because right then I took control of my life. I took control of who I am and who I'm going to be. And all of the things that my mum and dad had told me that I was supposed to be, you know, going to be a doctor, going to be a lawyer, going to be a solicitor, going to be an accountant, had to be this professional person, going to work hard, be good at school, all went out the window. And I chose to be what was emerging in me. Now, it wasn't a great, you know, I decided to be a clown at class and I was really good at that, have a good laugh, make people laugh, try and fit in, got the cane a few times by doing things that other people wouldn't do. But at least I was in control of my life. And so that night that you've now moved into, where I went to join the army, was actually a decision made by, I'm going to give you something else, by a guy called Kesey. Kesey was a guy at 12 who'd made a commitment to, because that's my African name, Kesey. And Kesey was a guy who decided to go to join the army. And it was Kesey, in that night in the barracks, who changed his name to the one that you know, Ronnie,
yeah.
And the people who are listening have got to know, which is Chris. Kesey made the decision.
That's an amazing moment for you. It's very mature. What you're doing here, you know, you're deciding. You've got that realization of where you are in the world, and then you join the army. I don't know about you. I felt completely at home when I joined the RAF. I'd wondered since I'd left school. I kind of, what am I going to do? I've got an education, but I just couldn't settle. And then, you know, last day, joined the RAF. Best thing I ever did. Did you really fit into, because it was a signal corps you joined initially, wasn't it?
Yeah, Royal Corps Signals. 100%. I fitted like a hand in a glove. The army's not for everybody, but it was for me. The army gives you discipline, gives you a team to belong to. It gives you a sense of significance. There's a role. We are achieving something. We are doing something. There's this unifying principle. And again, I met Scots people. And, you know, that's another one because, you know, having been brought up in England, for me, and please forgive me, anyone here is from Scotland or Ireland or Wales, but for me, England and United Kingdom were synonymous. I didn't realise that we were four different nations. And then, you know, in the barracks, I met Scots people and they were fervent, on fire people, and, you know, the Psalter, and when England played Scotland, they wanted Scotland to win because we used to have the Four Nations Championships. And see you or not, yeah, the language and the culture, you know. But, you know, so we had all these different people, but we all unified in Royal Corps Signals to deliver comms in field, in battle formation for the British Army. And so you had significance, you had a role, you had a commitment, and you had a Scotsman on your right, yeah. And you had a Welsh guy on your left, and you know, you were part of something. It was just, and I fitted in. You know, it was a brand new family, and black, white, on a different, just bring what you got, fella, bring what you got. And I had a lot to bring, and it was just great.
You then joined the Army Physical Education Corps, the PT, and that's where the kind of sport really, and certainly the athletic side. Prior to that, Chris, did you play any sport? Were you a footballer or anything like that, or did the Army bring it out of you?
So But the army pulled it out of me. What the army gave me that I didn't have as a kid was discipline. Mm-hmm. And so I played basketball at school, I played football at school, but I could never hold down a position because I'd turn up when I'd want to, I wouldn't turn up if I didn't want to, you know, that's training, by the way. I'd turn up to the matches, but I wasn't committed in training, didn't really listen to the drills that you were given. But when you join the army, you know, there are three things that they tell you: drill, discipline, and dress. And they're going to give you that each day, and every day you're going to get drilled. You're going to be conformed to a military discipline, and you're going to have to dress correctly. And so I was always prepared. And I got introduced to athletics by a guy called Sergeant McKenzie. He was the Army Athletics Officer when I was in the Signals, actually. But Sergeant McKenzie, he bought me my very first set of athletic spikes. He developed my very first training program. He put me into competitions. And so when you'd come back into camp, when people come back into camp on the weekend, some of Kingsley put into something we call company orders. Now, yeah, 50 years later on, we're modern intranets and we've got digital stuff. But we used to put all information up on the guard room. And so they'd come past the guard room and there it would be what happened the weekend, what happened that week. Junior Signalman Akabusi does it again. The Army Flyer does it again. And all of my wins were... And so all of a sudden I was getting affirmed for positive stuff. And then you're right. So when I make my segue from the Royal Signals into the Army Physical Training Corps, I'm in charge. I get attached to a unit. And I'm a sergeant. I'm attached to a military battalion. And in that military battalion, the colonel, who is basically chief executive officer of the regiment, the colonel says to me, "Sergeant Akabusi, you get my unit from 7 o'clock in the morning to 1 o'clock in the morning and you make us fit. Then you have yourself from 1 o'clock in the afternoon to 7 o'clock in the afternoon to get yourself fit." And that's where I became a world-class athlete.
Let's go to room two, because this is a room I think a lot of the listeners and the people I talk to in the podcast, I like to go behind the scenes because a lot of us don't get to go to where you've been. Let's go to 1991, the World Championships in Tokyo. You're in the 4x400 relay. The Americans are favourite to win, all right? And you know, it looks like it's second and third for the other squads there. But take me into the changing rooms. Take me into even the warming up area. Because I don't know, and a lot of us don't know, what it's like at that level of elite sport to be getting ready for this huge event watched by millions, probably billions across the world. What was it like? What's it just like to be there?
Right. So I'm going to take you back a step further. And that's the night before going to those changing rooms and going to the stage. Yeah? And I'm sleeping with Roger Pretty Boy Black. Bunk beds, but there you go. Roger and I were still in the same room because what you need to know, when you go away on these camps, you bunk up with somebody. You'll have your buddy. And from 1986 to 1991, Roger Black was my buddy. Roger was the quickest quarter miler and would normally run the last leg in the 4x4 relay. But that night, Roger and I, chewing the fat, realised that we had an opportunity to do more than place in the medals. But in order to do so, we needed to do something a little bit different. You know, anyone listening to this will know, normally when you run a relay, you put your best man last, your second best guy goes first, and your rubbish goes in the middle. And traditionally, I'd run the middle. Me and somebody else had run the middle. Because I'm a hurdler. And our best two guys are Roger Black and a guy called Derek Redmond. That night, I'm sleeping with Roger, chatting away. Well, I'm not sleeping. I'm chatting away. And I said to Roger, you know what, mate? This is an opportunity. I can actually do it. I can run the last leg. I'll train with you on a regular basis. I can run the last leg. Roger agreed. We talked all night about the different scenarios and how risky it was. Go to breakfast. Meet up with Roger. Meet up with John Regis and Derek Redmond and have a phenomenal conversation. What I call a yes and conversation. Normally when you come up with ideas, people go, no, but this and no, but that. And they have all the reasons why it won't work. But with John and Derek over breakfast. Yes, and this, yes. And we were really fired up. We'd gone to management. We'd had a sort of semi-intellectual discussion where there was a little bit of disagreement because we were nailed on to get a medal. But by doing this, it was a risk, you know, putting a 400-meter hurdler on the last leg. Luckily, in the end, management agreed with us. So now we go to the changing room. And I tell you what, there is nothing like going into a changing room with a group of guys fully committed to the goal. 100% prepared. Cheek by jowl. Gonna fight out for one another. When you go into this call room, so you've done all your warm up and you're out in the sort of periphery areas and you're doing your bit, you can still maintain your sense of self and well-being in your own psychic reality. When you get into the call room, there's you and seven other teams, and you're all funneling in, and you're showing your number, you're showing your spikes, and a little bit of the old psychological stares and glares going on. And then you sort of got to try to, then they say, they order you in your race positions. And you can see people turning around looking at us because what we've done, we put me, the old man, the former hurdle on last leg, and we put off only two quarter milers, Roger and Derek on the first two legs. So when they go into their pens, people are looking as if, what's going on here? But we know what we're doing, and we are now stone-faced. You know, we're in our individual pens, stone-faced. We've warmed up together, we've huddled one another, we've congratulated one another, we're there for each other. Now we're stone-faced. You go through your pen, down into the tunnel. And then as you go into the tunnel, Roger goes out on the track. When I say we're a man down, Roger's out there on his own now, ready for us. And we're there together. And you know there's that look that you look with one another. And you know that sense when you know it's going down and your heart is in your mouth and your skin is alive and your stomach is churning and you're looking at each other and you're trying to support one another while drawing from each other, one for yourself. And so I'm drawing off the boys because I'm going to see them secreted one at a time on the track. It's an awesome moment. We are there now at the edge of the track. It's do or die. No more try. Roger goes in and he looks magnificent. He's got this big, massive hammies and they're shaking loose and they're vibrant. And you can see the quads pumping. And I'm just jazzed up and we're ready to make history.
That puts a whole lot of new context on to seeing you coming down the straight. Because, and not just are you full of exhilaration, but you're focused on winning. But you know the plans come together. You know it's worked. And that must mean, God, your head must have just been bursting with, we did it. We outthought them, we've outrun them. And the Americans, I said, were favourite. And they were dumbfounded when they looked around and they were all looking at the time and just kind of going, what actually happened there?
100%. Well, you know, again, and as the race unfolds, you get more and more confidence because, you know, Roger gets that stick, bam, he goes around the track, hands over to Derek Redmond, the only other quarter miler. He gets that stick, cuts in off the first turn, gets in the first place, runs a phenomenal second leg. This gap opens up between him and the rest of the world. It's just him and America now. And normally Americans are out there on their jack. It's him in America now. Hands over John Regis. John gets that stick. Now, John's a 200-meter runner, and we've said to John, whatever you do, if you can't give back a boost, a 10-meter lead, you've got to stay on the guy's jock strap. John executes the race phenomenally. He wants to blast down the back straight, but listens to the plan because he knows if he puts me 2 or 3 meters up, they're going to chew me up for breakfast. If I'm on the jockstrap, I can actually get in behind the lee side and get what's the peloton effect, the coefficiency factor. John Mann's magnificent. Ties up a little bit in the last sort of 5 yards, but imagine John's run 200 metres longer than ever runs. Yeah. So hands over, sit to me. When I'm going down the back straight, I am so euphoric. I am so large. I am so full of the energy passed on by the boys. I'm going down the back straight and it feels like I am jogging. I really, I'm tall and it's like I'm almost running into the fella. Big screen, I look up at the rest of the track of the competitors are 15 metres down the track. Yeah. So I know it's a two-horse race. Go into the second turn. I'm now gathering my thoughts, thinking about the strategic advantage and when I'm going to deliver the extra step. Bam, off the turn. I go flying past this guy. And, you know, all the time, I've never even contemplated. It was never even in my mind that we were going to lose this. I knew we were going to win, except for the last 25 metres. Then all of a sudden, it dawns on me. Oh, my gosh, we're in the lead. Oh, my gosh, it's America. And I can hear the world champion on the last leg coming back at me. And I'm fumbling for the line. And I stumble across the line, and we are champion de Mons. It was an amazing moment. The boys jump on top of us. The crowd are going wild. The teams are going wild. Photographers are going wild. Only four individual Americans. I've got a long sour face.
It was such a great moment. The reality to get to that moment of euphoria is the years of practice. I'm looking out. We've got lovely weather here where I am today, but I can imagine you training in the coldest of weathers, and doing gym work. Tell me about a day when you were training. What would a normal day for you be then? Did you and were you right in the professional era then, or were you at the back end of the amateur?
Smack bang. So my athletic career came in that transition from what was called shamateurism to professionalism, and shamateurism was the practice of athletes getting illegal payments for extended. Overinflated expenses, for example, in order to compete. And it changed from that to bona fide trust funds, money going into accounts, and you could get sponsored. So that would happen from sort of the mid-80s into the 90s, and that was my athletic career. And so rather than retire in your late 20s, like so many other, for example, the person who held the British record for the 400 hurdles before me was David Hemery.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing athlete. Had to retire when he was 28 because he had to go work. Whereas, my best years happened in my early 30s. So, right smack bang in the middle of the professionalisation of the sport was my period.
So what was a normal day like then, Chris?
So, I mean, there is no real normal day, but basically I train 6 days a week, twice a day. And in any given day, I would be mixing speed endurance and technique work, or strength conditioning and speed work. And so if I give you a typical session, I might go out in February, April. I'll be doing speed endurance in February and April. And I might have something like, in the morning, two sets of three 300s. That's 300 metres. I'd run the 300 metre run in 33 and a half seconds. And I would have a 8 minute recovery between the individual 300s. I would then have a 15 minute recovery between the two sets and do exactly the same again. And you'd be trying to do sort of 33 and a half, and you'd probably end up running 33.9, 34 for the last couple because obviously you're bushwhacked. And then you'd go away and you'd replenish, re-energise, carbo loading. And then in the evening, I might do some sort of strength conditioning work, which would include plyometrics, which is hopping and bounding and getting the elasticity in your muscles, and I might do a few technique drills, high knee rolling, and a few light hurdles, snap downs. So that would be a day. But what you do see is that the whole day is focused around excellence, focused around breaking down small little micro parts of the event. And your whole world exists to make you this racing snake, to make you just totally ready for that day in August. And everybody in your life. So I'm hoping I'm also communicating how selfish it is to be an athlete, how myopically focused you are, and how the absolute clarity of what it takes to be an athlete, and how the whole environment you're with world has to conform to your way of being in the world. I mean, there is nothing like it, really.
I'm going to take you into your last room for now, and it's I'm putting you in the big room when you're doing your motivational speaking, because it struck me as well, because you know you're such a great storyteller, and you know when you're telling the story about the setup for the race and everything, that's just the hairs on the back of my neck were up there. But before we talk directly about the motivational speaker, I want to talk about your TV career. And I want to talk about, record breakers and the other things. You really got on well with Roy Castle, didn't you? Because Roy Castle was the main, and he always struck me as a really nice man. He was a Christian, and you're a Christian as well, Chris. And did you immediately sort of hit it off with Roy Castle?
Oh, Roy was a lovely guy, absolutely beautiful man. And I'm a totally accomplished artist. Sing, dance, act, crafty with his hands, you know, could create things with his hands. Great presenter. I was new, brought a load of energy into the event that we're doing at Record Breakers. But he was the one who told me about something called Shade and Light, that if you just bring all your energy, you overpower the room and people can't appreciate it. And so you have to learn the rhythm and the rhyme and the meter of life and the shade and light and be able to explode with all the energy and then come down on a crescendo and allow people to ride that wave as you just slowly describe what's going on and step back and allow the event to lead into the room. And so Roy was great at that. He was just great at colouring and bringing the audience into the room and then fading back. So it's not about him, it's about the audience experience or whatever's going on. So a great tutor, a great person to watch.
And what I mean, you've had these moments, these people in your life as well, Chris. And of course, the connection there is you've got somebody like Roy Castle who could do anything. You know, but he worked hard. He was a hard worker in everything he did. And bless him, you know, when he got the cancer, because he was still working late on and working in smoke-filled clubs. But he was all about excellence. And that to me is where you are now with your motivational speaking, because it's a great phrase and I picked out, or let me just try and remember it because it's a great one. The past is for reference and not residence. And I just went, wow, this is these wee phrases. And I suppose that's really who you are and where you've got to know, because I know I've managed to drag out some great stories about you, but you actually live the now like nobody else that I know of.
Yeah, 100%, Ronnie, 100%. Yeah, and that saying, it's a very short phrase. It's not easy to live up to. But the past is for reference, not for residence. It is sort of enticing to live in the past. There's a comfort in living in the past. You know, we know what went on in the past. And even sometimes the bad stuff makes us feel at home. because we know how to deal with the bad stuff. And so it's easier to want to hold on to the past. But it's not great stuff if you really want to move on and grab hold of your preferred and better future. So my idea is you take the best elements out of the past. It's not what happens to you that matters. It's what you make out of what happens to you that counts. Take the best elements and recreate your now in order to live your preferred and better future. And that is the whole dynamic of our transitions in life. And we're constantly transitioning. We're constantly being and becoming. We're constantly living in a world of possibilities until, of course, there is no further possibility because you shut off the mortal coil. But until that moment, until that final transition, there is this joy and verve in life where you continue make the most and play and recreate and dream big about what you want to become and talk about that and articulate about that and then commit to that. And, you know, that commitment is what precedes the confirmation of what it is you want to become. And you commit to that. And guess what? As you commit to your daily grind of being what it is you want to be, you draw in other people into your life who are also on their way, and you are the answer. You are the chink. You are the glue. You bring something into what they're trying to achieve. They bring something into what you try to achieve, and together we create something beautiful.
Let me just go in there with that, because you must see, I would imagine that very often you're brought in just for your mentoring aspect of your business as well, Chris. You're brought in because a manager or somebody's seen something, went, we're a very negative business. We're not performing as well as we could. Do you see a lot of negativity in business? Because, you know, we're going through tough times at the moment, pandemic and Brexit. When you go in, do you see people's heads down? They're doing a good job and they're committed, but they're not actually really enjoying the job and the life as well. Do you see a lot of that negativity being kind of circulating around that area?
So I see a lot of all sorts. I mean, there's many different moods and ways of being in the world as there are people. Generally, when I go into a company, I'm generally brought in at a big event. So 80% of my work is on stage with anything from 50 to 5,000 people. I'm now talking pre-COVID times, of course. But 50, 500 people in an auditorium, and it's a company sales kickoff, or it's the marketing team are delivering a message, or it's a new product launch, you know, and it's something where the C-suite have been communicating where we are, what we're trying to achieve, but, you know, they might be a little bit wooden, or they might be saying something that they've always said before, or there might be, as you've articulated, a real negativity within the team. For example, there might have been restructuring. So if there's been a restructuring in the business and the colleagues in the business are really unhappy because the 20% you got rid of represents 20 years of history that they've lived together, mm-hmm. and the team and the C-suite said, we need to fire these guys up. So then I will step in and I will deliver my keynote based around the themes that the C-suite are trying to deliver to the audience. And yeah, I will then pick up that team and say, whatever the past was about, we are in it in the here and now. And we need to brace the here and now in order to get there and then.
Your belief then, your belief in excellence, Chris, is crucial to you, the human being, and to where you are. What I wanted to finally just say to you, what about things like racism and where we are as a society in the UK? Because I have to ask that, because I think we're at a turning point right now. And you know, you've represented the country, and I just wondered whether you felt sometimes you didn't get the recognition you did because you were a black athlete.
Yeah. You know, Yeah, it's really tough way that is. It's a real tough question. You know, I've really thought a lot over the last sort of 2 or 3 months as I've seen sort of the Black Lives Matter movement, and I've seen, you know, I've seen what people have made of it. It's really tough. And I've seen racists on all sides of the spectrum. You know, it's really difficult because, you know, I've got a lot of white friends who themselves really feel marginalized right now. Don't know what they can say, what they can't say. There's just like linguistic police out there that are sort of policing and monitoring everything that people say. And part of being human is the way we take the rise out of ourselves. And you've got to be really careful what you can say and can't say. So I think it's real difficult times right now. There's clearly been some unacceptable stuff that's gone on. And in my day and today, the stuff that kicked off the recent experience with the George Floyd murder, you know, it's beyond the pale. And I have experienced my fair share of racism. But I've seen black people be racist. And it doesn't matter the fact that, you just because you're not in the majority, you know, when you start calling people names yourself, you know, one of my favorite authors, a guy called Friedrich Nietzsche, and he says, the will to truth is a will to power. The will to truth is a will to power. And so often, the striving to get your truth heard is striving for you to get your power dynamic in a framework. And it's one thing when you say it, look, I am a human being too, and treat me equal. That's one thing, and that's great. And of course, I believe in that. And I've had my fair share of marginalization as a soldier, as a sportsman, in TV, and in business. I've had my fair share of marginalization. And rightly or wrongly, I've said to myself, it is what it is, son. Get the chip off your shoulder, put your wheel to the plow, and find your way. And it's easy for me to say, because I've made my way in a very tough world. And I'm very glad that my children are having the playing field leveled a little bit so that they can actually bring and showcase their skills. But I want to be careful that the pendulum doesn't swing the other way. And then you have the general populace just scared of being human, of just bringing themselves to play. And if I say something wrong, okay, I'm sorry, mate. I didn't mean it. You know. Now, what does it mean? What does it mean? I didn't mean it. What does it mean? I didn't mean it. I didn't understand your context. Yeah, and I can't really go any further. But I see stuff going on, and I think, mate, this is just...
Chris...
We've got to be careful.
Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure and an honour to talk to you, because... I knew I'd have moments where you just, the hair, you know, because for us mere sort of mortals, especially with athletics, it's great to hear that. I'll put you in a happy room for a bit then, as we find out. What would be a happy room for you? And oh, the other thing is, why the hurdles? Because of all the things for a man to do, Chris, the hurdles is just gone, what, you want me to jump over? I've seen the hurdles. I've seen how tall they are. And, you know, I just would... Why would a man put himself through that?
Well, actually, I tell you what, Ronnie, contrary to popular belief, the 400 hurdles is easier than the 400 flat. Because in the 400 hurdles, every 35 metres, you've got something to think about, which is a hurdle. And so it's a distraction from the sheer pain of running a quarter. And you will know in your life that actually... when you've got back-breaking work to do, when you engage fully with that work and you split it up over a period of time and you get into it and you do it, actually time flies, you get the job done, and afterwards you feel happy and the job well done, and you've not really noticed how difficult that task is. And the same with the hurdles. That breaking it down every 35 minutes, bam, bam, running tall, bam, dragging yourself over. just police it out. When you cross the line, you feel great. So I chose the hurdles because I wasn't quick enough as a flat runner.
And what would be your happy room? And who would be in your happy room?
This is really, really cheesy. My happy room will be with my children.
That's not cheesy.
One thing that I'm really proud of in my life is being a father. I didn't have a role model as a child, and I've made it as an adult. And so in my happy room would be me and my four children and my four grandchildren. And they would say, Papa, you've done a good job, son.
Fantastic. I suppose the only regret you've got in your life, Chris, is you didn't join the RAF. You could have probably just gone to greater things, my friend. But, you know, you joined the army.
I'm going to let my laugh say it all there to that one. Crab air.
Big thank you, Chris Akibusi. Next week, I'll be speaking to Dame Joan Bakewell, broadcaster, journalist, and Labour Party member in the House of Lords.
I loved it. I didn't want to do anything else, but it did occur to me that it was about time that a woman read the news.
I'll see you next time in the room.